When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and today I am talking with Mark, a trauma surgeon, and we are going to go over generally lower extremity trauma. How's things going?
Good, but you interrupted that music. I was listening to it.
Yeah, you can listen to it later.
Okay.
No comedy here. So. But it's been a while since you've been on the podcast, so would you mind doing just a real quick intro?
Yeah, sure. Mark Shapiro, and I developed the medical proficiency training with the Special Forces medics, the 18 Deltas. Have been doing that for probably 6 years now, you know, since about 2014, and working with Ragged Edge Solutions, and that's what how I keep busy, and you know, I impart as much knowledge as I can on them, and they undoubtedly do the same with me. The civilian military collaboration is something that I think is super important, and I think we need to keep it up and keep everybody safe.
Yeah, absolutely, and we definitely appreciate it. So yeah, we're on location right now during Dark Woods here at Ragged Edge Solutions during their PFC course. And so I saw Mark and I saw a target opportunity, and so I took it. So what I'd like to get into, because this has been kind of a question and not necessarily a problem, but definitely a learning point during some of these training events, is orthopedic trauma. And the first thing we'll go over, I'd like to go over, is limb salvage. So, you know, I think, a traumatic amputation is generally pretty straightforward. Like, the limb is gone, you put a tourniquet on, and we move forward. But not always is it going to be a clean wound. It can be a mangled wound, compound fractures, et cetera, et cetera. And now the real question comes, is this limb salvageable or not? Should I approximate the tourniquet or not? So what I'd like to ask you is, how do you kind of approach this situation? What's your thought process with it?
Right. Well, as you and your listeners well know, there's blunt and penetrating trauma, and we tend to approach those a little differently, right? And so the mangled extremity almost implies, at least in the civilian world, that this is blunt trauma. However, you know, high energy rounds can, you know, behave in a similar fashion, where the limb is completely avulsed and you have a complete amputation. Similarly, penetrating trauma, you know, with a blunt edge device of any sort, whether like a combine, for instance, here in the civilian world, or, you know, or just a really blunt edge object at high energy, can really destroy the soft tissue to the point where it may not be salvageable. I think some thoughts are early on when you go and assess that limb is it bleeding? As I shared with the students yesterday, it's not uncommon for the arteries to be thrombosed, to be clotted. Typically, the veins are like that, but the arteries also, you know, very muscular. They'll retract and go into spasm, which is, you know, a life-saving event for many of these folks. And the ones that are partially transected are the ones that probably continue to bleed and become a problem. Good news is, hopefully, you can identify them, put a finger on them. The tourniquet will absolutely help identify them, and then hopefully you can tie them off or potentially shunt them, depending on where this is. If you're on the X, you're not going to do a shunt, But if you're close to help, that's certainly an option. So, so how do you assess it? I think the bottom line is, and most people would agree with this, is that if there's a blood supply and if there is innervation, if the innervation is intact, we're not talking sensation, we're talking mostly motor, if that's intact, you're going to do everything you can to salvage the limb, and at the least you're going to salvage as much length as possible. So why is that important? And it's important because of the energy and the metabolism associated with the length of the limb, okay? And even if you can't salvage the entire length that you're hoping to salvage, what you want to do is salvage as much soft tissue as possible. What do I mean by that? I mean muscle and skin. So the bone will have to be removed so that there's enough soft tissue to cover it for your prosthesis, and cover that bone so that over time, when the muscle atrophies and all that's left is the skin and the callus, the bone isn't creating another wound and penetrating through the skin essentially, and creating all kinds of problems for the patient.
When you're talking about assessing for motor, I guess what kind of assessment? Just can you move it? Can you move anything? The toes or?
Yeah. So on, you know, like I said, on the X, the medic is going to, if it's not care under fire, they're going to assess for a blood supply. They're going to look for a pulse. And even if they don't feel a pulse, it's too early to make a determination. Even if they get to a surgeon, you know, like if there's a JMAL or something there, they're probably not going to do a definitive amputation unless it is so mangled that they're, and the surgeon and the medic get a good exam. Mm-hmm. It's unlikely that they're going to get a definitive procedure. They're going to get it washed out. They're going to get it dressed. They're going to get their antibiotics, and they're going to get packaged to go to their next level of care. Mm-hmm. If they don't feel a pulse, you know, ultrasound is an option now. I think your medics are becoming absolutely facile with ultrasonography and how to identify an artery, a vein, and even to the point of better anatomical definition. So then that gets to the nerve. And if your patient's awake and they're able to respond, you're going to have them do some motor activity. You're going to see if they flex, extend, if they can adduct and abduct. If they can do that, they may have a chance. Now, let's say it's on a farm or someplace where the soil is absolutely filthy. It's going to be tough, but I don't think that the answer is whether you amputate or not right there. I think it's going to be defined over time. You know, the orthopedic literature has come up with a number of brilliant papers, teamwork, collaborations, rather, with a LEAP study and the METAL study. METAL looking particularly at military amputations, upper and lower extremity, where these consortiums, that's the word I was looking for, these consortiums are looking really at what can they get out of this? Is early amputation better? Remember years ago, around the Gulf War, people were saying early amputation, early rehab, better survival. Well, we've learned a lot. Unfortunately, that's what wars bring, a lot of education, a lot of learning opportunities. And although the answer isn't clear all the time, we are able to salvage limbs that we probably would have gone on to early amputation before. The issue that we see is military versus civilian. These tend to be younger people. These tend to be people who are in better shape and start off better. Sure, there's your smokers and things like that, and a few obese people. But the soft community and those folks who are susceptible to getting hit by an IED, these are generally young, healthy people that are suffering these amputations. So the blood supply in some ways may be better. And their attitude towards rehabilitation is probably better than people who are getting amputations for things like trauma, generally younger population, And then there's the patients who get amputations for comorbid disease like diabetics and so forth. And that's the nice thing about the metal studies or the metal consortiums is that they're looking basically at military, well, they are military folks.
Okay. Now, especially when we're talking about prolonged field care. Okay. So now kind of the challenge comes, you know, after an hour, 2 hours, etc., do I reduce or reapproximate this tourniquet? I ideally want to, but I have to decipher what is the risk, what is the reward. If I try and reapproximate it and it fails, the potential is, you know, he's going to continue to bleed. Versus, and maybe it's uncontrollable. Okay, I've just have to reapproximate it back to where it was. I had last control, I would think. But the risk for rebleeding is definitely there. Versus, you know, salvaging as much tissue as possible for prosthetics, per se. So usually that comes with an amputation. You know, is it above the knee? Is it below the knee? Things like that, at least from what I've heard. I guess if you were in that PFC situation, you have a mangled limb, I guess, and you have, you know, patient is being resuscitated. We're still kind of in that state, you know, hour two, hour three comes by and now we're really thinking like we should do something with this tourniquet. What is your thought process versus that risk versus reward?
So you've brought up a number of great questions and a number of great thoughts. And I'm going to try and answer them, and I'm trying not to go down that rabbit hole. So,
yeah,
just redirect me if I pause a little bit and try and figure out how to answer your question because there's so many things going on.
Okay.
So I'll just start sharing with you my thoughts as I were to come on to the roll on the patient that's down.
Mm-hmm.
So number one, you're absolutely correct. Every civilian, every military personnel should know how to put on a tourniquet by now. Mm-hmm. We know that's not the case, but at least we've got Stop the Bleed. That's been a very successful campaign worldwide. So you put the tourniquet on and you're going to put it on high. And if it doesn't, you know, you have to have the wind lass on your tourniquet, right? So almost all personnel has the tourniquet with a windlass. Mm-hmm. We're not going to get into wide band and narrow band type tourniquets. But what I am saying is belts and ties and shirts won't work unless you have something to make it excruciatingly painful. Mm-hmm. And that's what the windlass does. So you do that, and if that doesn't work, you're going to add a second tourniquet. The second tourniquet's now applied, and it's nice and high. So now you get the patient outside of danger, right? You move them to a safe place, and now you start to assess the wound. Sometimes you get lucky depending on how bad this injury is and you're able to see the vessels. So if you're able to tie off a single vessel that's bleeding, that's great. You win. Now you know the extent. IEDs, as you know, bring just horrific organisms deep within the wound, far higher than what we can see. And so you know that patient's going to need urgent irrigation and debridement, but more urgent than that is really getting those antibiotics on board. And that's been shown time and again that early antibiotics will make a difference. So now you've given the antibiotics, you're in a safe place, and now you're trying to evaluate, do we convert that tourniquet more distally to preserve more of that soft tissue that we were talking about earlier? And so the answer is, of course, you're definitely going to evaluate it. And so you let the tourniquet down, and it would reasonably believe that you're going to see some muscle bleeding. You don't ignore the muscle bleeding, but that's not the important stuff. The important stuff are really the big arteries and veins that you're dealing with. The veins can be a little tough to deal with sometimes because they're not as muscular. They can certainly bleed depending on how proximal they are. And yes, simple pressure will hold those off. If you can find them, tie them off. They tend to be a little fragile. The arteries, on the other hand, although it has some dramatic bleeding, they're more muscular. They're definitely able to hold a stitch. And even, you know, somebody whose catecholamines are rushing, who tends to break every suture, the arteries are, you know, they can handle a good stitch and a good rough knot. And so that's what you would do if you can see it. And then you don't have to worry about the tourniquet. And I think the reason why it's a good question is people think about tourniquets and arterial and venous bleeding. Venous tourniquets are useless for arteries. They're the ones that you start tightening down and the patient starts screaming and you never get that arterial hemorrhage to stop. An arterial tourniquet, what I mean is that you tighten that windlass down so tight that the artery stops. The problem is, and again, this is where I think you're coming from, is that when you tighten it down, you stop all blood supply to the area. So you get tissue damage in the form of skin, which really could render that limb ineffective. You would have to do, you know, numerous skin grafts to cover it, but you also take the muscle. And when you take the muscle, you take away the padding for that limb, for the prosthetic. And that's why it's essential to evaluate and see if you can convert that tourniquet more distally. If you don't do that, you have muscle necrosis, and that can lead to rhabdomyolysis, and rhabdomyolysis, kidney damage, you know, release of electrolytes and toxins and so forth, so that when you do release that tourniquet, the patient can become, you know, acutely hypotensive. And again, the whole washout with a potassium, you have to be prepared to protect the heart with that, with your calcium and potentially bicarb due to the brief acidosis. And fluids, right? Bicarb is not something that I would advocate for. And as far as treatment for rhabdomyolysis, just like mannitol, I wouldn't. You're just going to treat the rhabdo with fluid and pushing urine output greater than 100 milliliters an hour. And that's all on your JTS CPGs that everybody can check me on.
Right.
But again, it's that conversion of that tourniquet, that evaluation is going to be key once you get to a safe place.
So what would that limb have to look like for you to risk? It's worth taking the risk, reduce that tourniquet, because that's when you're going to find the bleed.
Correct. Right? Well, you would hope so, right? Sometimes right. The artery goes into spasm for hours.
Okay.
And so let's say that you don't find the bleeding vessel, the tourniquet is let down. Do not turn your back on that patient. Mm-hmm. In other words, the patient gets rewarmed, they get resuscitated, so they go from a blood pressure, systolic blood pressure, say of 80, and now they're in the 110s and 120s. Now they've got a pressure head and now they can bleed. And so I'm not saying, you know, although I think permissive hypotension, there's definitely a role in our patients. I am not talking about permissive hypotension. I'm talking about resuscitation where the patient's rewarmed, they're resuscitated with fluid. And obviously our favorite fluid is blood, whole blood. And now that pressure head allows the artery to bleed after the patient's been dressed, antibiotics, tourniquets has been reduced. People are paying attention to the other set of casualties and the dressing is getting soaked and nobody realizes it. And they've already lost a couple units of blood.
Right. Yep. Definitely. Because I think from the tourniquet conversions that I've seen, it's kind of like a 15-minute thing. You take the tourniquet down, it's not bleeding, okay, everything's good. You know, maybe I'll leave it on for now, but then at some point somebody's like, hey, I need a tourniquet. This guy doesn't really need it anymore. You know, it's been down for 30 minutes, no, he's not bleeding. And then suddenly he really needs it. He really needs it back. So I think people understand that a little bit more. Maybe not how long they need to be prepared for that. I think, you know, definitely you're right. You know, hours potentially watching this because it can reopen just with pressure alone or transport or any other movement. But where do I draw the line of it's worth the risk? to convert this tourniquet versus it is, I do not think this is salvageable. I do not think it's worth the risk. I'm going to leave the tourniquet where it is and preserve life versus limb.
Well, and I think that's the answer, right? If it's life versus limb, you're always going to, you know, keep that tourniquet. And again, if you can get an exam, if you can get a neurologic exam, a motor exam, then it's, you would do your best to preserve that limb. Mm-hmm. If you can't get a motor exam and the tourniquet hasn't been on, that limb is probably not going to survive. So should you do a completion amputation? And again, in the CPGs, we're preaching call telemedicine. There is somebody that's going to give you an answer. And what I would do today and what I would do tomorrow, it all depends on, you know, all the things that we say, it just depends. And for me to go over that list would not help anybody. It would just confuse people.
Right.
So motor exam and arterial supply, that's going to be your answer. That's what you're looking for, perfusion and motor. The data on people salvaging limbs who initially don't have plantar sensation is really showing us that, you know, just because you don't have it then doesn't mean you're never going to have it. And so the other thing are these, you know, these athletes, you know, it may be that there's so much destruction to the bone and so much both soft and bony destruction that an arthrodesis or basically fusing these joints together, that's not going to help these guys. They won't want that. They may ask for an amputation later. What I'm talking about is preserving that soft tissue so that in the event that an amputation is required, do the best you can. So what about that patient that has a very flail extremity? And many times you and I may be thinking of the lower extremity. We can't forget the upper extremity. And the upper extremity, we may think of things a little more differently, or at least a little more emotionally, because that's almost all of our livelihood. Mm-hmm. We're not talking surgeons. We're talking car mechanics. We're talking teachers. We're talking people who drive vehicles. So although, yes, you can drive without a limb and you can drive without two limbs, the fact is we are tied to our upper extremities a lot more emotionally than we are lower extremities.
Right. No, absolutely right. So if you had to choose, or I guess the deciding factor, pulse versus motor, which would you put your money on?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I do an assessment. I have a pulse. I have no motor.
If you have a pulse, that's great. So go with that. I would take that over motor. The motor, you know, takes time. The pulse is what you need relatively urgently. And yes, you can, you know, salvage a limb that's pulseless for hours, 4 to 6 hours. Six is always the book answer. But quite honestly, at 4 hours, you better be like prepping to get in the operating room, because by the time you get a shunt in there, at the very least, it's probably going to be pretty darn close to six. And most of our patients, you know, we joke and we say, well, they didn't read the book. The tissue is going to be ischemic. You are going to pay a big debt in that, between that 4 to 6 hours. You may even pay a big debt after 1 or 2 hours.
Right.
So, you know, a very muscular person, that's a big debt. That's a lot of dead muscle, mm-hmm, versus somebody who's a little more sinewy.
Right.
Yep.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Well, one more thing, and I think it's super important. It really gets to the gist of what you were talking about earlier, is how do you know whether you should preserve that length or not? And it's not a cosmetic question. It's an energy question. It's a metabolic question. And so to appreciate that, the shorter you go, the more energy it takes to move, right? And so for instance, somebody who just has part of their foot blown off, you know, 15% of their energy will be 15% more energy will be required to create locomotion versus something like a very low BKA, you know, that's, you know, maybe 10%, and a very short BKA goes up to 40%. And so all of a sudden, the amount of energy to move, stride, if you will, goes up exponentially. Transfemoral amputations from trauma, 70% of the energy is required to move. So these prostheses that we are using are getting better and better. It doesn't change what the body needs to create locomotion.
Right.
And so the questions you ask are critical because that could be the difference between an above-knee amputation and below-knee amputation by as much as 30% difference, right? So, if, you know, with femur at, you know, 68%, 70%, and a BKA, a below-knee amputation, you know, at anywhere between 10 and 40%, depending on where that is a big decision to make. And the responsibility to make that decision is enormous. And that's why if you do what you can to get that tourniquet as low as you can, identify those bleeders so you don't have to use a tourniquet, if at all possible. You just don't want to waste any blood. And that's, you know, probably one of our more valuable resources.
Mm-hmm. Another issue is we have pelvic fractures with concomitant femur fractures. Now, generally, we understand, hey, we're going to keep the pelvic binder on because that's the higher risk, right?
Right.
A good traction to go with that femur fracture, it's going to be pretty helpful for reducing pain and just getting everything kind of straightened out. What do you think about putting a traction splint with a concomitant pelvic fracture?
Right. So the reason why you want to, and what I'm thinking when you talk about pelvic fractures, I'm thinking about the S-tabular fractures and the posterior S-tabular fractures, big bad fractures. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily thinking about pubic rami or pelvic brim or anything like that. And so it all depends on how fast you can get those to an orthopedic surgeon who's going to do, you know, a nice reduction. And they may not even do a definitive reduction or a definitive surgery, but in general, that's the idea, is get them to get their definitive surgery as soon as possible for their pelvis. Their femur, which again, like you said, in the meantime, before they go for their surgery, reduction is key for blood loss and pain, and you're absolutely right on that. To apply that reduction, the way we do in the civilian world is really through a pin. We put a metal rod, you know, through the bone and apply weights at the end, and that's how we reduce it, and it gets the bone at length. Mm-hmm. Again, key for decreasing blood loss, key for pain management, and all of that's nice and well. So what happens when you have both? Well, if you have both, you're probably going to want to put both under traction, right? But what you don't want is a lot of movement and play in between. You don't want to disrupt clot. You don't want to cause an injury, scissor, knife, whatever, a nearby vessel. And so, although I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, and I didn't sleep at a Holiday Inn last night, I think that it is reasonable to apply some traction if you have both fractures at the same time and you're not able to get them somewhere where they can be get an external fixator on for either, quite frankly. But the S-tabular fracture really takes an expert, an orthopedic traumatologist. So I don't think you should withhold traction. You're not going to put a pin in. The medics are not going to put a pin in. It's unlikely that they're going to get a pin for traction. So that means probably a hair splint. And so here's my concern with traction. Now that I've gone through all that and say, well, if you need to do traction, you can do traction. The problem with that is the skin necrosis from prolonged traction on that ankle or distal tibia. So you have to be very thoughtful about that Velcro tie around the ankle and rendering that skin and ankle ischemic. Mm-hmm. So yes, you can apply traction. You probably have to give it a break every, you know, hour, 2 hours or so, and maybe you're just, you know, borrowing a medic or, you know, another teammate to apply manual traction to give the skin a break.
Okay. So kind of like your nursing care going with traction.
Yeah.
Just like bed sores and anything else.
Exactly. Exactly. Because you take that skin, you know, you're not going to want to do a skin graft, but, you know, you may have to. And that's over a joint that has all kinds of problems. So, yeah, you would have to pay particular attention if you had to sit there for 48, 72 hours on a patient with a, you know, a very complex femur fracture, acetabular fracture.
Right. So other than skin necrosis, because, I mean, that sounds bad, but, you know, the benefit of straightening that limb out is pretty big, right?
Acutely, it absolutely is.
Is there any other risks by putting traction or maybe even too much traction, any risk to the pelvis?
Well, you really, you know, if it's a hip fracture dislocation, you know, the dislocation is an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can get a femoral neck necrosis, femoral head necrosis, because of the very poor blood supply. Mm-hmm. And so that's got to be reduced. And if it's not reduced or not identified and not reduced, there are going to be some very long-term consequences with that patient. You know, I suppose, you know, you could have some midterm ones with infection because the bone doesn't have the blood supply it needs. And I'm assuming that this is done in a very unclean environment of one form or another. But arthritis is really going to be a big, big problem mm-hmm. for that patient, and they're going to have more surgeries later. Other big downstream complications, I'm really not, you know.
So what I'm thinking of, is that pelvic binder going to be strong enough? Assuming, of course, I've done everything correctly. It's in the proper place,
yeah.
You know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Is that going to be strong enough point for that traction to push against to give me a good traction for the femur without disrupting or worsening the pelvic fracture?
Yeah, and the bottom line is I don't know. We don't know, right? So in my mind, I'm thinking of a closed mm-hmm. Complex fracture, but you know, there's also open fractures where the angulation of that femur is right through the skin, and that is a horrific problem, especially in the field.
Okay,
you know, very, very high energy fracture, osteo, all that stuff is coming to bear. And you add to that the pelvic fracture. I don't know if you're going to be able to get enough traction on that to reduce that. And again, the hip dislocation, you can reduce the hip dislocation, but I don't know how you do that, reduce the hip dislocation with a big open femur fracture
right.
like that and keep it, you know, that's a really, really, really bad problem.
Right. So you think that would be worth a telemedicine call to go one direction or the other?
I think that would be the first thing on my mind.
Please help me.
Antibiotics, telemed, reduce.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Wash out somewhere down the line, but yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you're running into like multiple issues that are confounding each other, I definitely want to reach out to somebody like you who's far away from the situation and can think about the entire picture. And hopefully I can paint it well enough to help me think through the situation and give me some good advice. Because people kind of, I think, overestimate how well they're able to think under stress.
I think that's true for all of us.
Yeah.
And I think that's where experience comes in. And I'll be honest with you, if I was at the end of that telemedicine consult, I would be reaching out to an orthopedic traumatologist. I'm hoping that they have more experience with something that complex. But there's, you know, common sense wins almost all the time. Mm-hmm. And and especially the soft medics. You're just lucky if you run into those folks. In my experience working with them here at Ragged Edge and even on their medical proficiency training, not only is it a joy to work with them, there's a lot of exchange of information, and they help me think of things and prepare for questions like that, which I have received before. For any, you know, number of reasons, and that is not a typical, in my understanding, in my experience, that is not a typical bad problem that we encounter or asked to deal with, which mm-hmm. is that big open femur fracture, you know, deep or very acute angulation and a bad acetabular fracture together. Unless it's, you know, a bad IED, mm-hmm. And those patients who have all that together, those patients may not make it to us, and maybe that's why we don't get a lot of those calls.
Right, right. I mean, you're definitely talking about some big, strong bones, and if it's received that much energy to fracture them, he definitely is going to have other issues on top of all this, to complicate the situation even worse. For lower extremity trauma, is there anything else that you see guys struggling with?
You know, do I see them struggling with? It's the decision making, which arguably is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And I think they struggle with it because of A, inexperience, and B, there's not a lot written. To the point of, you know, maybe I shouldn't say there's not a lot. There's a ton of stuff written, but it's all one-off. It's anecdotes, and that's, you know, a lot of what we have to go on. You know, antibiotics early is always key, but antibiotics only go where there's a blood supply. Mm-hmm. So antibiotics and a tourniquet means that the end wound, the wound itself, isn't getting antibiotics. So you got to keep it clean and pack it, and I also think that at least in the soft medic community, they're very good at going with what they know, mm-hmm. and they do know to get antibiotics, and they do know to get the wound washed out, and they do know to stabilize the wound. So I think they're, you know, pretty comfortable with things, and I don't see them struggling with trying to treat the patient on the X. I mean, they're tactically fantastic, and strategically they're fantastic, and they do know to call for help.
Yeah, I mean, it always comes back to, you know, life versus limb, right?
Yes, sir.
So you stabilize the life, then we can start worrying about restoring the limb. I think, you know, you hit it real well. You know, just doing good assessments is going to help you make that decision, and it's not be an emotional one. It's or a feeling one. It's do your assessments. Is it can you get good perfusion to this area? Do you have good pulses? Do you have good cap refill? Do you see kind of that muscular bleeding that's going to tell you that this tissue is viable? And do you have any motor control on it as well? Just keep in mind that it may take some time to actually get that motor control back, because it's been without perfusion for an extended period of time.
I agree. And just to add one more caveat, and this isn't because where we're sitting and who we're working with right now, I think these exercises bring these questions up. And so the key part in my mind is you do not want to have to make that decision for the first time downrange. You need these exercises to be exposed to the question so that in your mind, a week from now, a couple days from now, or a couple months from now, you've already asked yourself the question. You already know what the real question is, so that you will come up with the best answer. And so, whether you do it here or you do it, you know, at Fort Bragg or Camp Lejeune, you need these exercises to get that question for the first time.
Right. Outstanding. Well, cool. Hey, thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Dennis.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. out. Every boy is waiting there for you.